Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Springtime brings many celebrations and festivals, both secular and religious. When it comes to which is the most food-centric, Passover trumps it all. Every bite of the traditional Seder supper is redolent with meaning. We've brought in the experts this week to help us explore Jewish food tradition. For more than 50 years, James Beard award-winning chef and author Joyce Goldstein has been one of America's go-to authorities on the subject. Joyce joins us to discuss the Mediterranean Jewish table. Tired of the lackluster jarred gefilte fish? Author Elizabeth Kurtz weighs in on creative kosher options for imaginative palates. And Chef Dan Essies gives us the skinny on a very special underground Seder supper annually attended by many of his Jewish New Orleans chef buddies. L'chaim, it's Passover time on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Joyce Goldstein, and my new book is called The New Mediterranean Jewish Table, Old World Recipes for the Modern Home.
When we think about Jewish food, most of what comes to mind could fill a deli counter on the Lower East Side. Open Joyce Goldstein's new cookbook, and you'll find something quite different. The Jewish diaspora across the globe created a cuisine that encompasses an amazing diversity of flavor. In compiling her book, Joyce set out to demystify Jewish cooking of the Mediterranean region. To begin, she addressed some of the common misconceptions people have about modern Jewish food.
See, most of the Jews that came to the United States came from Eastern Europe. They were the Ashkenazi Jews. And they settled on the East Coast, which is sort of media central. And the image that was projected is with blintzes and borscht and bagels and, you know, kugel and brisket. And so in the average person's mind, when you say Jewish food, they think bagels and lox or brisket. And it disregards this entire huge community of Jews from other parts of the world. But see, very few Mediterranean Jews came to this country. So I guess I would like people to realize that Jewish food is a huge vocabulary of recipes from other countries, but largely vegetable-based. And a much better and much more diverse diet.
I learned so much whenever I read one of your books. And I think it is fascinating that all these years later, you've come back to this topic because I think there have been possibly cultural food shifts. And there's ingredients that weren't available when you first started writing the book.
Absolutely true.
Tell me how you decided it was time for another book on this topic.
Well, I had been working with University of California Press, and we had just done Inside the California Food Revolution. And I enjoyed very much working with them, even though that book was probably the hardest book I've ever done in my life. And they said they would like to do a Jewish book, but sort of focusing on just the food of the Mediterranean Jews, because most of the Jewish cookbooks that are written are Ashkenazi food or, you know, modern takes on Ashkenazi food, and the market is saturated. And we felt that not enough attention had been placed on the much healthier Mediterranean diet and the food of the Mediterranean Jews. So that's where we began, and I realized that in all the work I had done before, I hadn't really concentrated as much on the Jews that grew up in Muslim countries, all the center part of the Middle East, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Jordan, all of those countries, and Iran. We had mostly focused on the more famous countries of the Mediterranean, Greece and Turkey, Italy, Spain, Portugal. And with all these Israeli chefs and Israeli cookbooks, there's a renewed interest in food from this part of the world. So it's sort of ironic that Israeli chefs are the ones that are bringing attention back to the food of the Mediterranean Jews.
I'm wondering if you could sort of walk us through the various spices and flavorings that define all of these different varieties of Jewish food and the people who cook it.
Okay, well, it's a very interesting story. If you look at Spain and Portugal, paprika, garlic, always lemon, always olive oil, a few herbs. But it's basically a fairly neutral cuisine, some cinnamon in the sweets. When you get to Italy, again, it's basil and parsley and a little nutmeg and a little cinnamon, but also pretty subdued. The Italians are not sitting around eating spicy Jewish food. Then you get to North Africa, and it's like a riot of all the different spices. I mean, between the charmoulas and the harissas and the preserved lemon and the caraway, coriander, cumin, you know, it's everything. Yet when you get to other parts of the Middle East, Greece and Turkey, you get the cinnamon tomato dynamic in Greece and the use of dill and mint. And Turkey maybe picks up a little bit on the allspice, but again, a little more subdued. And then you get to the Arab countries, the Mizrahi Jews, and some have some spices in it, but again, a more balanced palette of spices and herbs, and the introduction of ingredients like sumac and tahini, and the fruits of the quince, the figs, the dates, all of those sort of sweet and sour. And a lot of this comes from Iran. I mean, that whole sweet, sour fruit with meat thing started in Iran, made its way into North Africa, sort of through Morocco, and then up into Catalan Spain, and then over to Turkey. So it's formed a whole circle. It's sort of interesting that a good idea, a good flavor idea, has made its way all the way around the Med.
It's very fascinating to me, that whole transverse of countries and cultures. And as I understand it, one of the things you were doing was actually working with old recipes that said crazy things that 21st century cooks can't possibly translate, like an eggshell of this or
a mustard glass or some weird measurement. No, I mean, you became sort of a detective tracing these recipes and cooking them and trying to figure out what they meant. I mean, sometimes they'd say fold in the usual manner. Well, if you weren't there in that kitchen, who knows? So it really was a lot of trial and error, a lot of recipe testing. And then putting in the context of the modern palate, because today Americans want food that's a little bit more dynamic, a little bit more intense in flavor. And I think that when I was cooking these recipes, sometimes I'd say, man, I better increase the lemon juice, or, you know, I'd cook it for my family or friends. It's great, but it needs something. There's always it needs something. And often it was a squeeze of lemon or a little bit more heat or up the spices.
I think it's sort of mystifying, and people would like to learn more about what's kosher and what's not, but why?
Okay, first of all, there's no real definition of what makes something kosher. Like they said, well, you can't have pork because of trichinosis. No, that had nothing to do with it. It had to be correct and described in the Bible, you know. Mm-hmm. But the point is, there were no logical laws. A lot of them were just made up by authorities, religious authorities. And certainly the food of the Jews in the Middle East is a lot more permissive and broad than that of the Ashkenazi Jews. And in the Middle East, you can have legumes and rice during Passover, but you can't if you're an Ashkenazi Jew. But they realized that that was the basis of the diet in the Middle East, so you can't forbid people the food that keeps them alive.
Well, I love the fact that you've got a whole chapter about savory pastries in particular. And you mentioned that you're concerned that handmade pastries are endangered. You want to tell me about that?
Well, yeah. You know, in the old days, women did not go to work, so they had all day to cook. And it was, housing was very communal. Families lived together. They'd sometimes gather in a courtyard and sit around a table and do a lot of work together. In Algeria, I was reading about a family where the entire block made matzah for Passover together and did it each day so that each family had enough matzah to get through the holidays. So a lot of these women, there was no rush. No one had to go to soccer practice at 10 o'clock or whatever. They could cook all day and sit around the table and fold these little pastries and, you know, take their time. And now it's very lonely to sit and do a lot of these things by yourself. No, the high point of the day was standing around the table with other cooks tasting food and saying, all right, do we like it this way? What does it need? We want all to be in agreement so that when we serve this dish, this is our signature. And I love tasting with other people. And even now when I cook with my family, I'll say, will somebody taste this, please? Am I on the right track? Do you like it? Is this right? Because there's something about tasting communally that's a beautiful thing to do.
Well, eating is just a beautiful communal thing to do. And there's no better time for that than the holidays. A lot of the recipes in your book are earmarked for special holidays that occur during the Jewish calendar year. Let's go holiday hopping, shall we?
Well, I mean, there are many holidays, but the ones that most people know are Passover, Hanukkah, and Rosh Hashanah. Those are the biggies, and Purim, maybe. I think we mostly go now by seasonality and local food. And so, you know, when Passover comes, you know it's a spring festival, and that's when the asparagus and the favas and the artichokes appear at the market. And it makes you realize that in all the countries that are serving Easter and Passover food, those same ingredients are being served because that's what's in season.
I really would like to make the point that this book is far than just for being for Jewish people. This is a book for everybody because there's something in it that's going to thrill and delight every palate.
Well, thank you so much. You know, because it's basically a Mediterranean cookbook and trying to get a representation from all these different countries because you want people to realize how rich this culture is. And that there's more to life than brisket and potato latkes. That's what I want to say, way more. And once people try these recipes, they're going to be hooked on it because this is food that you eat forever, for longevity. The Mediterranean diet is the healthiest diet we know. And you never get bored because there's such variety with the uses of spices and herbs and condiments. I mean, it's more than meat and potatoes.
Joyce Goldstein, author of The New Mediterranean Jewish Table. When we return from a short break, author Elizabeth Kurtz joins us with creative kosher options for inventive palates. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and Cafe B, featuring contemporary Creole cuisine with an emphasis on fresh Gulf seafood served in a classic old Metairie setting. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events on Metairie Road. Exodus. Elizabeth Kurtz started her Jewish food blog, she quickly discovered that there was a lack of kosher options for imaginative palates. That's when her experimentation began. We caught up with Elizabeth coming off the heels of her recent publication, Celebrate, Food, Family, Shabbos.
So I started writing about 8 years ago. I started my website. It's called gourmetkoshercooking.com. Even then, I'd wanted to write a book. And when I saw what was going on online, like the explosion of food websites and the explosion of television shows, I said, there's nothing out there in the kosher world. So literally on a whim, I started a kosher website and started posting recipes and reaching out to different people. And right away, it took off. And through my readership, I was able to connect to the Jerusalem Post and quite a few other Jewish publications who took some of my food articles and my food columns and have been publishing them and posting them for quite a few years now.
Well, congratulations with that.
Thank you.
One of the fascinating things to me about Jewish cooking, and I think right now we're seeing this very fascinating trend roll across the United States where Israeli food is becoming the hot new cuisine. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think that in the food world, we're always looking for new trends for people to follow. And as we've, over the last, decade or so, moved towards healthier food, you see food from that region, they have so many healthy ingredients, lots of herbs and spices that are just naturally delicious and super full of flavor, like, sumac and za'atar, and then tahini being infused into salad dressings, and like I even have a tahini cookie in the book. And although there is fat from sesame paste, it's a more natural, healthy way to cook. So I think the combination of the success and the trend setting and maybe just the improvement of their cuisine coupled with the healthy component has made it a place to watch in terms of the cuisine.
To me, a real trademark of that Israeli cuisine is the way that so many cultures all ended up together in Israel, and they all seem to have taken one tradition from another and blended it together until you've got this new international style of cooking that is Israeli food. And you really do hit a lot of the international different styles and elements that could be included on the Shabbos dinner table or on any kosher table.
Thank you. You know, I happen to love international cuisine in general. So I kind of have been on a mission for the last 15 years or so to try to figure out how to make almost anything kosher. I mean, there are certain foods with certain mouthfeels or certain flavors that are difficult to replicate, but there are so many out there that can be substituted for and use other ingredients that sort of mirror or copy the flavor or the texture that literally makes almost anything kosher.
What was the most challenging thing in that vein you came up with?
So there are certain things that you can't seem to mimic, like calamari. You just can't mimic that kosher. And the other thing that's hard to mimic is bacon, but I've come up with some pastrami, some very thin sliced pastrami, and you can bake it in the oven with a little bit of maple syrup or brown sugar, and you can get like that maple glazed bacon taste without obviously using the pork bacon, which we don't eat in a kosher kitchen. The other thing that's challenging is in a kosher kitchen, we don't mix milk and meat together. So there are some fantastic products out there today, like soy milk or some of the non-dairy sour creams and cream cheeses that act and feel just like the dairy equivalent, but they taste fantastic with certain other flavors added to them. They feel exactly the same in a recipe, and you can make the flavor combination really just come to life.
Elizabeth Kurtz, author of Celebrate, Food, Family, Shabbos. And the women. Longtime New Orleanians will certainly remember Jewish food authority Mildred Covert. For years, Mildred wrote regular columns for the Times-Picayune, exploring the ways to eat Creole and Cajun while keeping kosher. Sadly, we lost Mildred in May of 2015, but we wanted to remember her at Passover time this year with an interview that originally aired on Louisiana Eats in April of 2011. Mildred, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you very much.
Please, describe Passover at your home.
It's hectic. That's the one thing I can say. Because to keep Passover, of course, the home has to be cleansed of all foods that are forbidden to eat during the eight-day festival. And it takes a lot of energy and a lot of effort to do that. But we do, and we have our own separate dishes and pots and pans, etc., in order to cook and to prepare for what we call the Seder. But I have to tell you that when it comes to Passover, it is such a solemn holiday and restricted in so many ways culinary-wise that it does become difficult to fuse some of the Creole and the Cajun cooking. However, I can always find a way to sneak around something or to bring a little touch of the Creole and the Cajun into the Passover kitchen.
Well, give us some ideas about how you go about
that.
Well,
for instance, we can use tomatoes, which is a big thing. And I have, you know about the fried green tomatoes here in the South.
Of course.
And I have taken fried green tomatoes into the Passover kitchen. All I used was the matzo meal instead of the cornmeal and the flour. And, of course, the seasonings is all the same. I've also made what I called a matzo Napoleon
And
dessert.
What is that?
I have layered the matzos with, you know, chocolate pudding layer and sometimes fresh strawberries or whatever you want, and let it sit in that refrigerator for a while, and the matzo begins to kind of soften a little bit and cut it up.
Oh, that
so
sounds delicious.
So there's ways to kind of, you know, kind of get around or just put in a little something extra. But I have to admit that Passover really is more difficult to infuse outside foods. We cannot have anything that has any leavening in it. There are beans and there are peas that cannot be used. Corn cannot be used. So you really have to be careful with the ingredients that you use during Passover.
So I'd never heard this restriction about corn and beans and peas. Why can't they be included?
I think it has something to do with the fermentation, but I'm not really clear on that. All I know is that these kind of lentils were forbidden, so we go along with this. This is the law of Passover.
Would you walk us through your Passover meal from start until finish and what you're serving? Because it's a long evening at the table, right?
Yes, it is. The main thing on a Passover table would be what we call the Seder plate. And on that plate, there are several symbolic pieces of food that are on there. You have pieces of parsley, which represent the spring of the year. And then you have something called haroses, which is made with chopped apples and nuts and a little bit of wine. And, of course, they are variations from there. You have also a lamb shank bone, which is seared and burned. And that represents the sacrifice in those days of the altar. So you have these symbolic symbols that begin the Seder. And when the Seder begins, the youngest child asks four questions, which ask you, you know, why is this night different from any other night? And we start off reading what we call the Haggadah, which is the little booklet that we use to read and explain what the Seder is all about. And when we reach the middle part is where we finally break to eat. And my traditional Seders have always been, we started off with the gefilte fish. Mm-hmm. You do your matzo ball soup, chicken soup. And from there, it's either the chicken or the roast. And here is where, like I say, if they're going to fix a roast, we can always put in a little Creole tomato sauce on the roast. And I'll tell you another thing that's very common down south. We cannot eat peanuts during Passover, but we can eat pecans. And a lot of recipes outside of this area of the country calls for almonds and walnuts. I use the pecans to make the haroses with and pecans to put into my cakes or my pies. And I think that's a little southern touch right there with pecans.
Well, as a little Gentile girl, I can't say as I ever quite acquired a taste for gefilte fish, But you and I were talking about gefilte fish the other day, and you described a way that you prepare it that I have to say I think could convert me.
Again, as I say, sometimes I really need an MD degree because I am a master of doctoring things, the MD in the kitchen. Gefilte fish comes in little balls about the size of maybe an inch or so. I would take those little balls, drain it, and pat it dry, and roll it in matzo meal. Now, no additional seasoning because seasoning is already into those little balls. And again, here we come with some nice hot oil. And drop it, which is southern, right there, frying again. And drop it into the hot oil, pull it out when it browns, stick a toothpick in it, put it on a little hors d'oeuvre plate, and tell the kids, this is your Passover crab ball.
That's great.
Which, of course, it wasn't. But it really is very tasty. It's great for an appetizer or, you know, if you have the time. Most people, when it comes to the Seder, by the time they get the Seder meal together, they really don't have time. But you've got 8 days of Passover where you can play around with whatever you want.
Well, Mildred, I want to be the very first to wish you great blessings on this Passover. Thanks for joining us on Louisiana Eats.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Our friend, the late Creole Cajun kosher maven, Mildred Covert. The Yiddish word treif can be used to describe foods considered unkosher and prohibited under Talmudic law. For award-winning author and food blogger Alyssa Altman, the word takes on an even broader definition. In her second book-length memoir, Treif, My Life as an Unorthodox Outlaw, Alyssa explores how tradition, religion, and the forbidden impacted her childhood growing up in Queens, New York. We spoke with Alyssa about her memoir and the role food has played in her life.
You know, food is a constant for all of us, whether it's front and center of our lives or it's something that is less than the sort of lightning rod, because it isn't a lightning rod for everybody. It is certainly for me. And when I grew up in the late 1960s and early 70s in New York, we were always at the table. And at the same time, the table was not always a place of great joy. It could be sometimes, but it could also be a place of great enmity. And so food was the thing that really tied us all together, certainly at holidays, but also, you know, at times as mundane as dinner time and breakfast time.
It's very interesting, the dichotomy between the way you grew up, your two sets of grandparents. Your father's parents in particular were extremely religious, observative Jews.
Yes. My father's father, came here in 1905 at 11 years old by himself. He ran away from arguably, you know, an abusive home life in a tiny town in the Ukraine. My grandmother, my father's mother, came here from Romania when she was 2 years old. Obviously, they were observant. They were very connected to their faith. They were very grounded in their faith as well as their culture. Both my mother's parents were born here. My grandmother was born in 1901 in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, which I guess that would make her the original hipster. And her husband was born in 1893 in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, and they were Americans through and through. They had very little connection to their Austro-Hungarian past, and that was how they raised my mother. And so my mother didn't grow up with any kind of contradiction or paradox. That was just who she was. But when my parents got together, here was my father, you know, the child of religious observant immigrants, and my mother, who was not, And then when I came along, I was kind of, you know, pushed and pulled in different directions and got all sorts of mixed messages on a regular basis. And, it, you know, there was a certain amount of ambiguity that I grew up with and that I still struggle with, even now, all those years later. I always look in the mirror at, you know, times of the holidays and wonder, who am I? What am I? And that's the question that Trafe tries to unknot it.
In Trafe, you actually describe, near the beginning of the book, driving off a long distance to see a farmer about your Tamworth hog purchase.
This is true. I have a small family. There are just two of us, and no two people need a half a hog. They just don't. It's just the way it is. But I drove off up to Massachusetts. I had this hog raised for me. I shared it with some other people. And I went to pick it up, and I drove home. And as I was driving home, it was the fall. And so, it was getting darker earlier. And I realized that it was a Friday night. It was the Jewish Sabbath. And here I was driving home with 150 pounds of pig in my, in the back seat of my car. And then that sort of sets the stage for the, issues of paradox and contradiction that follow me through life.
And yet, your kitchen at home in Connecticut has so much family memorabilia in it, and I love the way you describe the hutch, the cabinet of one of your grandmothers that you say gives off small clouds of chicken fat when you open the doors.
I'm completely convinced, and my father used to say that this was true, that chicken fat or what we call schmaltz is so strong and it's so dense that I believe that when you cook it, when you render it every single week for as long as my grandmother rendered it, because that was her cooking fat of choice, it sort of infuses everything in furniture and clothes. And I used to walk into her apartment building when I was a little kid and hallways smelled like schmaltz.
Your Gaga, your grandmother, why was her goulash the most treasured meal to you?
Her goulash was the most treasured meal because when she made it, it was the tie that bound us together, and I loved it. And I'm a big stew lover, and I'm probably a big stew lover because of that. But she made it. I didn't grow up with any siblings, and so it was often just me and Gaga, and she practically lived in our house. And in the 70s, my mother went back to work full-time, and my father was working full-time. And so very often, I would come home from school, and it was just Gaga and me in the kitchen, and so that's what she would cook for me. And it got so that whenever she said to me, "What would you like me to make for you?" and I would say, "Make me your goulash," she would stand in the kitchen and just wouldn't look up until that goulash was done. And nobody had ever done anything like that for me before. And so it was the tie that bound us together. And as I'm talking to you about it, my mouth is watering.
Do you have the recipe and you make it?
My grandmother was not a recipe writer. She was an amazing natural cook. I think she was one of the best natural cooks I've ever known, but we didn't have any cookbooks in the house. She never looked at a newspaper recipe or a clipping. But I spent, 18 years of my life watching her make it, and recently I actually wrote it as part of an article for the Wall Street Journal. And it was good. It was good, but it felt like it wasn't Grandma and it wasn't Gaga. And my mother said to me, "Well, do you have a sense of what was missing?" And I said, "Yeah, Gaga."
Well, it is often the hand that stirs the pot. Any of us
it
who
is,
love food,
indeed.
Yeah, we know that. Well, it is certainly a fascinating, fascinating cultural study of immigrants and life in America. And certainly your life in particular. And I'm so grateful to have had the chance to have this conversation with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Alyssa Altman, author of Trafe, My Life as an Unorthodox Outlaw. can you find thousands of kosher recipes without opening a cookbook? Stay tuned, and we'll tell you where when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blend beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold.
Avadim hayinu lefar ubamitzrayim.
Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. Where can you find thousands of kosher recipes without opening a cookbook? While researching material for this episode, we came across an incredibly useful website entitled What Else? But kosher.com. The kosher.com site, which launched in December of last year, is an amazing resource. It boasts a massive collection of free searchable recipes, vivid videos, cooking and serving ideas, with new content being added every day. Does your family have health-related dietary issues like gluten allergies? Don't worry, kosher.com has recipes for that. The website is dedicated to making this, their very first Passover season online, the best ever, with innovative Seder table settings, Passover Prep 101, step-by-step guides to making recipes, ways to use up chametz before Passover, and even things to do with your kids during the bread-free holiday. So give this year's Passover celebration a makeover by checking out kosher.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
My name is Daniel Esses. I am the chef owner at Three Muses and Three Muses Maple and owner of Esses Foods Pasta.
In such a gastronomically gifted town as New Orleans, there's no way the Passover feast known as Seder could go unobserved. After doing some digging, we discovered an underground Seder for the Jewish chefs of New Orleans, organized by none other than Daniel Esses. Along with his thriving dining establishments, Daniel admits to being a master of his own Jewish kitchen at home.
Oh yeah, I've been known to make a really good matzo ball soup in my days.
To that, I say, yum! Daniel agreed to let us in on some of the details of his Passover celebration, from the symbolic food that goes on his Seder plate to his many family traditions that are still evolving. So I understand that there's some sort of underground chef's Passover that happens.
Well, it started 4 or 5 years ago, and I basically, you know, I wanted to share my Passover Seder with some of my close Jewish chef friends, and I invited David Slater, Richard Papier, and Nathaniel Zimmet and Jeff Barron and their significant others and some of my close friends and my wife's friends, and just to join us for Passover one of the nights. It's usually the second night that we do it.
What makes that Passover dinner special?
Well, it's really the guests and sharing the stories with people who maybe, you know, don't always know all the details that I learned when I was a kid. So I really like to share, you know, all the nuances and the symbolism to friends of mine who don't really, they know what it's sort of about, but not really what the symbolism for. And so, you know, food and Judaism, they're almost synonymous with each other because the religion is so tied together with food and there's so much symbolism to it that it really is exciting for me to share that with my friends and their guests.
How do you portray that symbolism at your Passover supper? Take us through the foods, what they symbolize, and maybe what you do to serve them that night.
Well, it all starts with the table before dinner. You have the Passover Seder plate that has the lamb shank bone. It has the bitter herbs. It has the charoset. And, you know, there's Sephardic and Ashkenazic Jews, the, you know, Middle Eastern and Spanish Jews are the Sephardic Jews, and they do their charoset differently. And I always portray that one because that's what I am. I'm Sephardic. And then the Ashkenazic, which is Eastern European, and that's, you know, apples and walnuts, which is what a lot of people are used to seeing. So you take dates and raisins and you steep them in, you know, if you're going to get fancy, you steep them in cognac or port wine and you steep them until they soften up and then you add walnuts to it and you just kind of mash it. So it really looks like mortar. And that's basically what charoset is supposed to symbolize, is the mortar. And then you make a sandwich where you take the matzah and some lettuce and you put a little bit of that in and it gets passed around and then you all say uchluchu, uchluchu. It just means like you all eat, we all eat. And that was something that, as a kid, that I really loved when my father used to do because he has a little accent. He's from Cuba and his parents came from Syria. And I just, as a kid, I just loved that, the way he used to say it. And he still says it to this day, but it's even cuter because he's like 85 years old. So, but that's something I always look forward to doing is, you know, the sandwich. And then off to the side, we do the three layers of matzah. The middle layer being the afikoman, which is what is taken out in the middle of the Seder and hidden so the kids can find it and get some money later in the week. And that's always exciting. It's either money or a gift or something like that, but normally it's about $5 to $20, depending on who's running the Seder.
Oh, I'm not familiar with that. So how do the kids find the money? What happens?
It's the matzah. So basically, at some point during the Seder, it's all in the Haggadah, which is the book that you follow, and it tells the story of the Jewish people leaving Egypt. And it gets to the point where, okay, now it's time to break the middle matzah, and the father who was leading it would go hide it. And after we finished the Seder portion of it and we were eating, we, as kids, would just kind of frolic around looking for it. And if we found it, we gave it to the leader of the Seder, and they would give us money.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, you know, what's really interesting to me is that a dear friend of mine who was a New Orleanian and really helped translate Louisiana food onto the Jewish table was Mildred Covered.
Mm-hmm.
And she says that her grandmother made gefilte fish with trout.
Yeah.
Do you think that might make it better?
No. I think if you really love fish, I think if homemade gefilte fish is really good. But gefilte fish is a peasant food. My mother's side of the family grew up in a shtetl. Like, if you know Fiddler on the Roof, that's the village that her family came from. And so it's just, you know, pureed fish that's boiled into a cake. It's really nasty and gelatinous, but some people really love it. And I'm not one of those people.
It must be childhood memories that make them love it, don't you think? So let's get past the scary gefilte fish. Mm-hmm. And what comes next on your table?
The matzo ball soup. And that's kind of where I take pride in making. I made what we call them knedelach, and that's the Yiddish word for matzo ball soup. Well, knedel is the matzo ball. And so I used to make that with my mom when I was a little kid. And every year I always forget the recipe, so I always have to call her. And then, you know, there's really one ingredient that I can share with your listeners to make the most authentic matzo ball soup possible, but it's almost impossible to find here in New Orleans. It's parsley root.
Parsley root.
Parsley root. It looks like a parsnip, but it's actually the root of the parsley. And that imparts an amazing flavor to your soup.
Wow. Well, that sounds really delicious. Next course?
Well, the next course, it all depends on the year. Some years I like to go traditional, and I'll just do the straight-up brisket and my kugels. Or other years, I'll do something more Middle Eastern, and other years, I might go French. It'll always be a brisket, and I'll always braise the brisket in the oven. I like to keep my Passover seder very traditional because it's the one time a year that I am traditional. Other people like to go and be different and creative, which I totally get and understand, but I do that all year, and I want my Jewish food to be as traditional to remind me as much of my childhood as possible.
When you look back over these special seders that you have held at your home, what are some of your best memories?
Well, I would say the first one I ever did was in Tucson in 1997, and was my first year really not living at home for Passover, for any major holiday. And it was with friends of mine, and it was a vegetarian Passover. And I still remember that really well because it was really good friends, and you know, it meant a lot to me to have them around. Whatever religion you are, when you start to celebrate it without your family for the first time, there's a lot of meaning there. So you're really starting new traditions, and you're starting, you know, new memories and new thoughts, and it was very meaningful for me. And then I know I did, a lot of the seders are written in older English, and they're written in like he said, and oh, God is a he, and this and that. And so I decided to do one seder where it was, you know, either she or non-gender. And that was really amazing because, you know, a lot of people really appreciated that at the seder, and it made me happy to be like, you know, married, and I have a daughter, and it's just, it's, you know, I want everyone to feel that they're part of it.
And now that you do have a daughter, how old is she now, Dan?
She's 18 months, almost 18 months.
And what are you looking forward to at Passover with her in years to come?
The obvious one is that she reads the four questions, the Manash Tana, Halayla Hazeh, what is so different about tonight? The youngest one is always supposed to say it. And when you get to that point where you can say it, you know, you're part of the Seder, which is another rites of passage. You know, before you're just kind of in the kids' table and, you know, be quiet. But, you know, we all remember the first time we've said our questions. You know, I remember when I said them, and, you know, that's something that I look forward to as well with her.
That was chef and restaurateur Daniel Essies. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we take a trip to Belgium with Polly Watts of the Avenue Pub.
You could go to Belgium and have an extraordinary beer-centric trip and really only visit a couple of breweries and still come back with an amazing experience.
Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Or you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake and white chocolate bread pudding in the historic Worldline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Reggie Morris, and especially this week to Sarah Holtz, who spearheaded our Louisiana Eats Passover celebration. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, or see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.